better come on in my kitchen. There's hard to be raining her do.
Come over here, kid. Why, sir? You never know, you might have to cook for 20 guys someday. You see, you start out with a little bit of oil. You fry some garlic.
It's
and you throw in some tomatoes, tomato paste, you fry it, you make sure it doesn't stick. You got to do a boil, you shove in all your sausage and your meatballs. Huh? And a little bit of wine. A little bit of sugar.
Delicious.
And that's my trick.
When the moon hits your eye like a big pizza pie, that's amore.
Enough. I'm so sick and tired of hearing you people talk about food, food, food. That's all anybody ever talks about is prosciutto, cheese, and fava beans. I'm drowning here.
Jesus Christ, take it easy.
We're not even engaged yet.
When you're married, you'll understand the importance of fresh produce.
I eat with gusto, damn your bet, my country, tis of thee. I eat for social progress, I eat for victory.
Delicious.
Stay hungry, stay hungry, stay hungry.
You want some more?
Good evening and welcome to Mouthful, the wine country's most delicious hour. November 1st already. Oh my, I hope you had a fabulous Halloween and that you're doing something really good to somehow commemorate El Dia de los Muertos. My favorite time of the year, that's for sure. We talked about the holiday last week on Mouthful, though. This week we're going to New York, and it's about time. Lots of things have been happening to make me think of certainly my favorite American city, maybe my favorite city in the world. One of those things has been a book that came across my desk a few weeks ago, Appetite City, A Culinary History of New York by William Grimes. Welcome to Mouthful.
Well, thank you.
How long you get to be in the Bay Area?
Just a couple of days.
Couple of days, yeah. And I should ask you right away, do you prefer to be called William or Bill?
Well, as long as we're here, just Bill.
Okay, you never know.
Even the name on the book is William, but nobody, you know, William, you got to shorten.
Well, some people named Anthony, for example, get offended if you call them Tony, so I always ask. I've got to say, first of all, when I got the book, I always just thumbed through, I think probably everyone does, and two things struck me immediately. There are no recipes. And I praise both you and your editor for not adding recipes.
Well, in many cases, we wouldn't even know how to find the recipes. There's certainly lots of menus that we looked at, but
sure,
not necessarily recipes attached.
And I think that is a real strength of this book. I think one of the tendencies, and I sometimes think it's been the marketing department or an editor with a particular frame of mind about sales, they just they tack on recipes even though they're not, you know, specifically resonant with the text. And so I really, it's like, oh, this is going to be a fabulous read. And you start at the beginning.
Yes, begin at the beginning.
Yes, and that's great. It's, you know, there's the other thing that I find sort of annoying about food right now. I mean, as glorious as it is that we have options we didn't have even a decade ago and certainly not a generation ago, there's so much focus on the next new thing, the next hot thing, who's the next top chef, whatever, that to start at the beginning of New York, a city with no restaurants, and just go forward, it just promises so many things, which is, number one, a good read.
Well, it's not a cookbook.
Yes, it's not.
As you point out, it's not a cookbook. It's really a social history. Mm-hmm. It's a time machine that takes you back to New York in different eras and kind of tells you, like, what if I were a New Yorker in 1840 or 1880 or 1920 and I'm hungry and I want to eat, where would I eat? And this you know, that question always intrigued me when I was a restaurant critic at the Times, and this book is my answer to my own question in a way. Like, where were people eating and what was it like and what would it have felt like to be in these different restaurants in, pick a year, 1840, 1903, 1948. Mm-hmm.
So, well, let's go to the very beginning. I found it really interesting. What was it like in New York when that city was first forming it, first birthing itself?
Well, we're talking about just around 1825, and if you remember your history, that's when the Erie Canal opened for business. And that was a transformative moment for New York as a commercial center. It propelled it. It put rocket fuel into the sea to allow it to just surpass every other city in the United States and become a major metropolitan international city, attracting not just immigrants with no money, but immigrants with lots of money, businessmen and traders. Now, what did that mean for food? It meant everything for food. In 1820, if you wanted food in New York, you could get it outside the home, but you went to a tavern or you went to one of these places called ordinaries where they served at a set hour a set menu. And you paid your money. You got no choice. They threw the food down in front of you, meat and two veg, very basic. And not very inspiring.
Almost sounds like sort of like boarding house.
Lots of boarding houses too. Absolutely. I mean, yeah. There weren't enough hotels really to accommodate, and boarding houses filled the gap, and boarding houses served food. And we know exactly what kind of food they served because of this great English journalist who wrote a book in the 1840s called The Physiology of New York Boarding Houses. And he was so fascinated by them, had lived in so many of them, he took notes and set down sort of what you could get at the different styles of boarding house. And a lot of it was just absolutely wretched. So in 1827, these three brothers from Switzerland named Delmonico created a little French-style cafe way down at the tip of Manhattan where everything was. And this was the first little, you know, the weather vane, the first breath of fresh air, a little foreign accent that was being brought to New York. And it was from that little seed grew all these fabulous restaurants that were to come in the next decades. But it was little more than a cafe, you know, where you'd go to like get today in Little Italy. You can go to these places to get cannoli and an espresso. Mm-hmm. It was kind of like that, just a few chairs, a few tables, some pastries, some liqueurs. But it had a distinctive French accent, and it was like nothing the city had ever seen.
At that point, so we're talking about 1820, mm-hmm. that decade, what was the population about?
Well, you know, it's not much larger than a college town mm-hmm. today. So we, even though it was by American standards, it was a metropolis in terms of who you would see every day and the dimensions, physical dimensions of the city, it was more like sort of a Midwestern college town, say. Mm-hmm. Now, over the next decade by decade, it just sort of, you know, the population would double, then double again, then double again. And that translated in food terms, that translated into this huge diversity, proliferation of restaurants, types of restaurants, types of cuisine as one wave of immigrant, ethnic immigrants came in, brought their food styles with them, and began serving that to New Yorkers who were always, I have to say, very adventurous and quick to pick up on very exotic cuisines that came in mm-hmm. into the port.
Wonder what it was about the temperament of the time that allowed for that openness, because that wasn't common everywhere.
I think New York has always been this restless, open city. Uh-huh. And it's always – and the waves of immigrants were not just external immigrants. They were the ones from these farms in upstate New York or from the Midwest. One of my favorite figures in the book is the novelist William Dean Howells, an Ohio boy who came to New York. And I think he's kind of an archetypal figure, like many of us who weren't born in New York but came to New York just thirsting for adventure and exotic experience and wanting to taste and try different things. And a lot of the different things were the experiences in these little restaurants or in out-of-the-way places where they served food that nobody had ever heard of in Ohio, you know, or Pennsylvania and these other places. So it was a city where there was a great openness to new experience.
Mm-hmm. So in a way, really, just the act of going to New York meant you, so that was a you kind were
of,
open.
Yeah, it was a kind of declaration yeah. that you're planting uh-huh. your flag almost by doing that.
Yeah. Now, that was at a time, if you think back, people weren't traveling quickly. It took a while. Getting to the tip of Manhattan would have taken a long time if you didn't live there.
Mm-hmm. Well, this is you put your finger on a key ingredient in how restaurants grew in New York. In most towns and cities in the country, laborers lived above the shop or they lived so close to the little miniature factory that they went home for lunch. And very quickly in New York, there was a separation between the business district downtown and where people lived, and it was too far away for people to go and have lunch. So one of the first things that happened way down in the business district was this enormous army of hungry people at lunchtime, and institutions had to be developed to feed these hungry masses. And so early on, you get these restaurants that just astounded foreigners because they would do a huge lunchtime trade, and the rate at which food was consumed, nobody could even fathom in Europe. There's all these accounts of people, Englishmen in particular, would see this stampede up the stairs to these restaurants in Lower Manhattan. People would eat sometimes standing up. They would eat in as little as 20 minutes and stampede down the stairs. And then the people trying to come up the stairs, there would be this gridlock and a human scrum. And in the course of an hour and a half of a lunch period, thousands of people might eat at a particular restaurant and then get back to the business of making money, which is what New York was all about.
Now, is there much of a record of what people were eating in these places?
Sure. We have a pretty good sense that in a lot of cases they were eating oyster was one of the paramount ingredients in New York cuisine because the oyster beds were just teeming,
and they were right there.
And they were right there, and it's gruesome to think about now, somebody sort of eating an oyster from off the New York shoreline at 57th Street. But for a long time, you could get oysters up and down and off Staten Island and Raritan Bay in New Jersey. It was one of the richest oyster-producing areas in the world, and New York just feasted on them in every form. I mean, oysters were served in, 100 different varieties, roasted, broiled, in sandwiches, and raw on the half shell, on carts in the street, and in very sophisticated restaurants that developed, some of them in Fulton Market, where they started out as just wholesale oyster dealers, figuring out that, I could in addition to selling them by the bushel, I can sell them by the half shell on this little plank I've set up between two barrels. And I can put in a few chairs here and add a stove and make some oyster stews and oyster pan roasts. And those were just staple of the diet for no matter how rich you were, or how poor you were, oysters were on your menu. And then, of course, there was a lot of English-influenced, I said meat and two veg, kind of half-jokingly, but that remained a staple at inexpensive restaurants all the way down the line. It would just, lamb and mutton were a bigger item in those days than today, and they got a lot of it shipped over from England. The ships in particular, as the shipping got speedier, the restaurants would buy from sort of the extras coming from the passenger ships coming over from England.
Okay.
They would get mutton from the South Downs, and a lot of English English chop house owners would specialize in broiled mutton, steaks, chops, seafood as well. That's the antecedent of the steakhouse, I suppose. It was more of a tavern kind of a setting, but the menu was kind of a steakhouse menu.
Mm-hmm. What were people drinking at the time, especially, say, during lunch?
Well, they were drinking English-style beverages until the 1840s when Germans came over and revolutionized drinking because they introduced lager beer, which initially people thought couldn't quite figure out what it was. They initially thought lager beer had no alcohol. It seemed so weak relative to these kind of hefty British brews and stouts, stouts and ales that they'd been drinking. They had this notion that it was like that you could drink it indefinitely and not get drunk. And eventually, though, lager beer became the predominant beer style in the United States. It took a little while, though. It was regarded curiously at first.
So people were drinking that and then going back to work. They weren't drinking water, right?
Lots of them drank water, sure.
They did?
But
so
remember,
the sources of water were okay at that point?
They were able to get water piped in from the Croton Aqueduct.
Okay.
And keep in mind also that Americans drank a huge amount before about the 1830s. Americans drank about four times as much per capita as they do today. Mm-hmm. By then, the temperance movement began to make inroads, and an American consumption has been very moderate on the international, by international standards, ever since the 1840s mm-hmm. or so. It's been, and lager beer has a lot to do with that. It weaned people away from hard liquor. I should mention, you asked what they were drinking. They were drinking a lot of cocktails. So it was a lot of whiskey. The three martini mm-hmm. lunch was,
so they didn't have the
martini.
Early.
They didn't have the martini, but they had the alcohol. Yeah, they were drinking uh-huh. like stiff drinks.
Stiff drinks.
Mm-hmm.
Wow. And still New York became what it is today. It didn't seem to hurt them too much, I guess. What about procuring ingredients? I know that there were a lot of farms and ranches on the island, right?
Well, yes, there were. I mean, it was extraordinary. This is one of the most interesting aspects of New York up to the 20th century is the market system. I mean, we're used to thinking of European cities as having these fabulous, extensive markets with the best produce and the best meats, and the cheesemaker has his stand here. And it was like that in New York. New York had two huge markets that were really cities within the city. One was Washington Market, which was only displaced when they built the World Trade Center in the 70s, and Fulton Market, which people find confusing. They think they know it because they – Fulton Fish Market. Well, the Fulton Fish Market was a little tiny appendage added on in the 1860s, but the Fulton Market started out in the 1820s, and it was a maze of butcher stalls, produce stalls. The size of it's very. I try to get it across in the book. It's mind-boggling the size and the extent of it. There would just be absolute traffic jams on both rivers as farmers came from New Jersey and Long Island with their carts. They'd line up the night before to go to the market, and they'd be ferried across the next morning. There would be cattle drives from Pennsylvania and Ohio to get all that beef into Manhattan. Remember, there's a lot of hungry people who needed to be fed. And where were they going to get that food? Well, they got it from farmers. And those farmers had to get their goods to market and float them across the river. I mean, drowning cows were a problem in those days.
Really?
Yeah. They would slip off the barges occasionally. And, of course, the oyster sloops mm-hmm. and the fishermen would be competing for part of the way people in Manhattan fight for parking spaces on the street. That's what they were doing all up and down the Hudson and the East River, trying to get their goods to the marketplaces. And the markets became so extensive. They included not just food, but almost anything you wanted to buy, from shoelaces to used novels to it was a city within the city, mm-hmm. and good restaurants developed in those places.
That was going to be my next question.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, like the they were most famous for these little oyster stands, and it was generally the oyster dealers who would turn to doing a little retail trade on the side, and that retail trade on the side eventually became their big business. There was this guy, Alfred P. Dorlan. Dorlan's was a renowned fish restaurant, oyster and fish restaurant in the Fulton Market that carried on for decades and decades and decades, and that was a great restaurant by every account. And the Dorlan family, actually, there's a second Dorlan's that opened up, and then a pretend Dorlan's that used the name and opened up on Madison Square. All of them prospered. All of them thrived because they were excellent restaurants. And they had heavy, heavy traffic from the ferry that went to Brooklyn. So if you have big crowds going to the theater, they would go back home to Brooklyn. They would go through the Fulton Market, and they would have a late evening supper at these restaurants that had grown up in the markets, and then take the ferry back to Brooklyn. Very lively scene, you know. It was all – the theaters were great engines of culinary progress because they drew vast crowds. Right. Almost every theater had a chop house, an oyster cellar nearby where people would eat.
Do we know when the oyster beds around the island were depleted or too polluted to rely on?
Well, the very last ones, I think, were closed down in the 1920s. So they lasted for a long time. And we still have, you know, there are still beds on Long Island. I mean, if you go to the Oyster Bar in Grand Central, there will mm-hmm. always be Blue Points on the menu mm-hmm. there. So if Long Island maintains oyster beds, but by – you can – one of the fascinating things to read about as I researched this book was every year the oyster – season of the oyster harvest was a big news and was covered in all the newspapers. There would be prognostication, and here's what it looks like for the Shrewsburys this year, and it looks like our early reports are the very healthy growth over there on Raritan Bay in New Jersey. And they would go down these lists of names that are all just extinct today, just dozens upon dozens of types of oyster. One of the most famous was this super prestige oyster called the Saddle Rock, which was a chance discovery when there was a howling storm one year at the spot where in the Great Gatsby, it's where Gatsby has his estate.
Okay.
Right off there, there was a huge storm that exposed some very rich oyster beds that nobody knew about. And it was like the gold rush. Everybody went in there and they stripped that bare within a few years. But the Saddle Rocks were so luscious and of such great size that they still figured on menus for decades after that because they were just – it was cheating. They would just say, well, we have – you know, at a premium price, you can get Saddle Rocks. There were no Saddle Rocks.
Uh-huh. So
and oyster dealers knew that, but it was they were putting one over on the public.
And is that one gone extinct?
Gone extinct.
Gone forever.
A mere memory.
Yeah. So do you know – do we know – does anyone know at the height of the oyster's popularity in New York, how many oyster restaurants – how many oysters stand? You know, do we know a number?
I saw a number, and it was in the thousands,
wow.
Like 3,000.
Mm-hmm.
It's impossible to know
sure.
how bona fide that number was,
yeah, but
certainly
a lot.
It's certainly the case yeah. that no matter where you went, there would be anything from a rudimentary oyster stand where you just buy it on a street for a penny, It was kind of interesting. We know the condiments they used. It tended to be just a little sprinkling of salt mm-hmm. or a little vinegar or lemon juice. And then later on, they started adding things like ketchup and horseradish.
Mm-hmm.
But initially, it wasn't like that. But the poor guy with just a couple of pennies in his pocket could eat oysters. And then there would be this elaborate oyster cellars, as they called them. All up and down Canal Street, there were oyster cellars that advertised – themselves a little like the Japanese places that hang out the paper lantern. They would mm-hmm. put out a red globe. It was a paper over bamboo. It was a big red globe illuminated inside with a candle. So you knew that's where there was an oyster cellar. And they called it the Canal Street Plan. I think just for a few pennies, you could eat oysters. And then they had these glorious places with carpeting and chandeliers. And that was at the very high end. You could pay a lot of money to go in those places, but it was just oysters up and down.
When did Grand Central Oyster Bar open?
Well, it's not that old. It's it dates to the 1920s.
1920s, okay.
So, and it's the last hurrah. I mean, if you do, I think it still gives you the little whiff of what they must have been like. There's really the last of the Mohicans, in a way,
yeah.
of what it once was of what once was in New York in the mm-hmm. 19th century. And so I've always enjoyed eating there just for that reason. It has it's one of the most authentic New York feeling places, and it gives you I have this fascination with New York dining history, so that's one of the places where you can feel a little surge of what it must have been like.
It's always a place I have to go at least once every time that I go to New York, and it's usually if I can swing it, it's the first place I go.
But sit at the counter. Don't eat in
yes,
the restaurant.
Sit at the counter. I am with you all the way. I used to like it. I guess it's gone now with the big remodel. The little tiny, like, adjunct, you could go in, that little tiny space, and you could go in and just get a couple dozen oysters on a paper plate.
Well, there's
with the takeout.
Yeah, you can still get the – people stand up and they on their way to their train, there's that window that they push stuff through.
Oh, there is still that window.
Yeah, it's still there.
I think the
unless
last time
something happened that I didn't see.
I think the last time I was looking for it, maybe it was – that part hadn't been finished yet.
Because
then I just ended up going in and sitting at the bar, at that long bar
right,
with a nice
that low counter.
Dim lights. Then there are other oyster bars. There's certainly Pearl Oyster Bar now.
Mm-hmm.
But am I right in thinking that the oyster bars that are in New York now are new?
Yes.
They don't have that same heritage.
No, they don't. But I applaud them because
Pearl Oyster Bar is fabulous.
Yeah, that's a nice little place. I don't think it has the same kind of. It doesn't feel like those old places must have felt. But I think they do a good job.
Yeah, and they make a real good lobster roll.
Yeah, well, that's a more a New England thing than a New York thing.
Yeah. I had that on my mind earlier this week, and now I'm thinking of it again. Well, let's go back in time again to the earlier part of the book. When did restaurants in New York begin to really distinguish themselves and create sort of, I guess you'd say, the buzz that maybe you'd hear about Parisian restaurants or that sort of thing?
Well, I would say by the 1840s, you start seeing some serious dining spots that were giving Delmonico's a run for its money. And there was one in a place called the Globe Hotel. It was called Blancard, run by a Frenchman. And he didn't keep it going very long, but while he kept it going, it was reputedly one of the great high-end French restaurants. And at the same time, you also see French restaurants at sort of the bistro level. I was surprised to see that the French were getting a great foothold in New York, and not just in the area of restaurants, but sort of all areas of the finer things in life. That seems to be what the French were born to do for us, at least at that time. And so New York was francophilic city from the get-go, to the point where newspaper writers would just sort of satirize it in disgust that the French are taking over. And up and down Broadway, all you see is these street signs or these store signs saying Madame this and Monsieur this and French gloves and French hats. And one guy was complaining. He said, how would the French like it if we went over there and started selling pumpkin pie in Paris, you know? So he was there was a certain populist reaction against it, but New York ignored it. Well,
you know, freedom fries from not so long ago. Mm-hmm. There just seems to be that sort of rise and fall of, you know, I don't know. I think it's
exasperation and love.
Yeah.
In the same numbers. But the French got, you know, it was undeniable that it was the capital of fine dining, was Paris. And they sent over – New York was very attractive to French chefs because they could make them a lot of money very quickly, and they could rise at a much faster rate than they could in a French restaurant where you had to do this laborious apprenticeship and over many, many years rise up the chain of command. Mm-hmm. You could short-circuit that whole process by coming to New York, and many – French chefs did. I mean, it was just a constant stream of culinary talent coming from Paris, and New York had the appetite for it.
It seems like it still does.
Yeah.
It doesn't seem like that's ever really waned.
Well, you know, regardless of whether the French have run out of ideas or whether they seem to be stuck and they're not doing anything new, what they still have is this great sense of craft, tradition, and training. And you know, U.S. chefs, whether it's molecular gastronomy or not, find that they can profit by going to France and spending, you know, doing these little apprenticeships here, there, and everywhere in France, because there's just the way they educate chefs is – well, if you get a chance sometime, read Jacques Pepin's memoir, The Apprentice,
which is
a beautiful book,
not just
about food,
yes,
but about French culture. In fact, I think it's one of the finest books about French culture I've ever read. But that'll give you a sense of what traditional French culinary training was like and how you end up knowing as much as he does about techniques. Yeah.
Now, we had Jacques on when that book first came out.
Mm-hmm.
We had him on talking about it. And then just very, very recently three or four weeks ago, we rebroadcast the interview with him as part of this whole looking back at Julia Child. So I should probably get that up as a podcast because Jacques is just one of the most warmest and most articulate representatives, I think, of French culture that we have.
Yeah, amen to that.
You are listening to A Mouthful here on KRCB. My guest, William Grimes, Appetite City, A Culinary History of New York. We'll be right back.
The French are glad to die for love. They delight in fighting duels. But I prefer a man who lives and gives expensive jewels. A kiss on the hand may be quite continental, but diamonds.
Okay, well, William, you know, I could talk to you just about the first chapter of your book for a couple of hours, I'm sure, but maybe we should move on a little bit. What was the arc of Delmonico's?
Well, it started out as this little cafe. Very quickly, developed much grander ambitions, and under the stewardship of Lorenzo Delmonico, a younger member of the family who was brought over, it became quite imperial in its designs, and it wanted the top tier of New York society as its own, as its clientele, and it succeeded in capturing them and keeping them for decades and decades and decades. For nearly a century, this was the restaurant that was at the synonymous with fine dining in New York. Now, by the time we get – and it changed locations. It moved – it was very shrewdly moved uptown as New York expanded and the center of gravity kept moving north. So by the 1890s, it's hopped all the way from the tip of Manhattan where it was founded to 44th and 5th, just across – just two blocks up from – the public library wasn't there quite yet, but if you read The Alienist, you know there's this closing
yes.
scene where they go chasing around the top of the Croton Reservoir there, and two blocks away is where Delmonico's was and its arch rival, a restaurant called Sherry's. Those two competed for the 400 was what the elite of New York was known by that time, and they divided the trade between them. But already they were facing competition from this newer, brasher kind of restaurant called the Lobster Palace, which grew up in Times Square just after the turn of the century. But Delmonico's staked its claim for a certain kind of patron, very well-to-do, conservative. Delmonico's was where you bought – where they had the great banquets every night of the year for fraternal orders and civic societies and associations. It was the place where the best New York families brought their daughters to cotillions and parties, and where the businessmen and tycoon, this is the old money, not the brash new post-Civil War money, would go to dine and to talk business and to fraternize with their equals. So it was it fell during Prohibition. That was the end, as it was for so many restaurants. And by that time, it was a dinosaur, and it was a relic from another era. But this is a restaurant that lasted nearly a century, at most of that time running at its peak.
So it fell during Prohibition, and I was wondering, between World War I, Prohibition, and World War II, what happened?
Well, devastation. Particularly, and it started really even before the United States entered the war. There were restrictions on hours, restrictions on meat. There was a lot of military preparation even before America entered the war, and it was having its effect in Times Square. The lights were getting dimmer and dimmer. There was a sense that the party was coming to an end, and Prohibition just turned out the lights overnight. A lot of restaurateurs couldn't quite believe it, and they tried to carry on thinking that no one can really be serious, particularly French and Italians. They couldn't believe that this – how could this be? And they tried to pretend that the law didn't exist. Well, they got a rude reminder. A lot of these guys ended up spending a little time in jail, and then they figured out that I've got to find a different way to make a living. That was – it was really 0 hour for New York dining, and it didn't recover for decades. It was – once you remove wine and spirits from the equation of dining, what do you have left? You have a very strange, sort of anemic restaurant culture. The Depression then dealt its second blow to what was already a horrible situation. You really, you know, you can't have that culture of extravagant spending and fine dining that there had been in Times Square. Just, if you look at Times Square, it used to be a deluxe dining venue from about 1900 till the First World War. There were the restaurants, the Lobster Palaces there were sort of kind of splashy Vegas-style restaurants, but with high culinary standards. You'd go there to spend a lot and be seen and to see stars, celebrity watching, people watching. Chorus girls would go on the arm of their sugar daddies. All the stars from the Broadway reviews would go into these restaurants late at night. It was just one of the most exciting, glamorous scenes in New York dining. Well, if you went there in the 1920s, all those Lobster Palaces, a lot of the Chinese restaurateurs took them over and created these very successful cut-rate restaurants where secretaries during the day could get lunch for 15 cents. And at night, there'd be no cover charge. There'd be dancing, and you could get a Chinese meal, and the whole deal would cost you maybe a dollar. There was an entrepreneur who put on these kind of Busby Berkeley style chorus girl leg show plus dinner for a dollar and a quarter. A guy named Nils Thor Granlund. He would go to Hollywood and sort of do a talent search and bring back the best looking lineup of beautiful legs that he could and put them on front and center at these places across each other on Broadway called the Hollywood and the Paradise. And that was, as you can see, I mean, that's a different kind of dining experience than these elaborate, mm-hmm.
yeah,
elaborate menus
different.
That were being sold at Rector's.
Okay, well, I want to jump ahead to what I think is 1949 and the Automat.
Oh, well, look, you know, you could have the Horn and Hard Art is the company synonymous with the Automat. But there was a company that preceded it.
Okay.
In 1903, it opened an Automat around 12th and Broadway, and you'd go in. The system was too complicated. It involved getting kind of a brass check, and you pushed the little brass thing in a slot. That went down, and it presented an order to the kitchen. And it was the thing that Horn and Hardart did. This company went out of business fairly quickly.
Horn and Hardart.
Horn and Hardart, after the two Philadelphia guys who ran a coffee shop and got excited by this German and technology for delivering food in an automated way. They opened a couple of them in Pennsylvania, in Philadelphia, then tried their luck in Times Square in 1912. And they had a winning formula. At that point, they had engineers who had perfected the technology of presenting the food, and it went very smoothly, and New Yorkers really took to it. And the Automat spread like crazy. So by the 1940s and 1950s, you couldn't think of New York without thinking of – I know when I was a kid and I my mother took me to New York for kind of a ritual family visit when I was 10. That was one of the things we had to do. You had to go eat at the Automat.
Mm-hmm. And what were they – wasn't it lions that –
They had little dolphin spouts.
Dolphin spouts, that's right.
When you wanted to get your coffee or your tea, they went through these dolphin spouts. Now, that earlier Automat, the 1903 one, you could actually get mixed drinks, which is
really?
A really bizarre concept.
You could get automatic.
Yeah, gin and tonic from their spout.
And what happened to the Automat? Where are they now?
Where are they now? Well, may you ask. Well, they lingered. They lingered, but they were really driven out by
fast food chain
restaurants. So I think the last one died. It was across from this New York Daily News building, and it died in the early 80s. New York Magazine ran a nostalgic, very long photo spread, and reminiscences by people who had survived at the Automat. This was where struggling actors and writers would eke out a meal for – they could get a little – baked beans for lunch, and then they'd come back for dinner, and for a quarter, they could make do and get by.
Well, we have to take a musical break, and if you listen closely to the words of this very familiar song, you'll understand why. We need to hear this now. Okay, did you hear that? It always makes me smile, especially now that, I'm a California girl. I didn't know from Automat when I was growing up. I think I saw one on my first trip to New York, and I didn't know anything about its perspective. And in fact, until one of my best friends today, his mother was a Horn.
Oh, really?
Yeah, so that I got to hear a little bit about the family.
Yeah, well, the family, some of the descendants got together and they put together a little book a few years ago.
I have a copy of that book.
Uh-huh. Well, it's a good little source because it's got great photo research. They did good
fabulous
photo research on that. So
yes.
You can really take a little trip back in time by looking at that.
Well, I feel like we probably should jump to the present time in New York. Such an important culinary, nexus for the country and for the world. But before we do that, I have to ask you a question. Do you watch Mad Men?
I don't. I hear about it, but I haven't watched it. And I hear they do a lot of – I know they do a lot of cocktail drinking. And
they
since
do
that's
a lot
one
of
my little subjects, I've always meant to check in and make sure that they're drinking the right drinks and going to the right places. You know?
They do a lot of – they drink a lot of cocktails. They drink a lot of scotch in the office. And they go out to dinner. They entertain clients. And they eat a lot of oysters.
Well,
so
good for
I was going to ask you exactly that. Do you think they're doing things authentically? And you see them cooking in the home a little bit too. It's just as a period piece, aside from anything to do with the plot and character and that sort of thing. It's very interesting to see the way that they really evoke that time period of the early 60s.
I think they take the period research pretty seriously.
Yeah.
So I suspect they've got it pretty close to right. Although I'm a little suspicious about this cooking at the home business, but
well, it's not very good cooking.
Well, then that's authentic.
Yeah, not very good at all. except if there's a special dinner party when someone's entertaining, you know, her husband's, you know, business colleagues. Mm-hmm. But one thing, now I forget what I was going to say. Let's see if it comes back to me. Oh, I know. There was in the restaurants they go to. First of all, they dress up.
Sure.
They dress up, and I love that. And the waiters, for the most part, are older. There's often a French flair to it. It's usually French food. And the whole interaction is much more formal than you would really see now.
Mm-hmm. Well, that was the style. I mean, if you go, you can catch it still at restaurants like Le Perigord or Le Grand Oui, where you see these captains in tuxedos and the service is rather formal, and certainly the people, it's definitely an older clientele, and people dress up for it. A lot of that has really fallen by the way. I mean, I see people that, when I was a restaurant critic, I was really always appalled at these 3- and 4-star restaurants. You see some guy coming in a tracksuit.
Yeah, and absolutely.
Bringing down the tone for absolutely everybody else, and usually for their girlfriends who would have been, you know, who understand what it means to go out and dress up, and they don't seem to have communicated this to these louts that they're going out with. So maybe they should start watching Mad Men and get an idea of how to.
You know, I keep hoping that that will be part of the impact of Mad Men, that there'll be this sort of cocktail style glamour out in the public sphere again. It's really I think it's a lot of fun. So what is going on in New York today? Molecular gastronomy. Let's see, who are some of the big names? Daniel Boulou,
of course, is great.
Jean-Georges
Van Gerichten has his own empire. I think David Chang, whose little restaurants, in a way, are the wave of the future, and you can see it in Paris as well. These very personal, very small restaurants, often kind of no reservations, a lot of the pretense is just kind of kicked to the side, and it's a very personal expression of a chef who is not kind of courting the press or courting clientele in the way that some of these bigger, older French restaurants or global restaurants have in the past. They're more personal laboratories with maybe, you know, 10 or 15 tables. Wiley Dufresne was like that, I think. You got a first glimpse of that wave of the future when Wiley Dufresne opened a 51 or 71 Clinton Fresh Food down on Clinton Street. Now he has WD-50 right across the street. But in both cases, it was – in his case, you felt like there was a bit of the mad scientist at work. But regardless, it was highly personal cuisine served to sort of an in-the-know, small crowd – not courting a lot of publicity. The publicity came anyway.
Sure, as it's going to.
Inevitably.
Yeah.
But it was a different idea of how you put together a restaurant. It wasn't real fancy in the way that the decor wasn't fancy. There was not a big publicity blitz. Very personal and very finely wrought, I would say.
Mm-hmm. One of the things you always hear about if you know New York because of movies or television or that sort of thing, if you don't know it personally, you'd think everybody in New York did takeout, you know, had 20 menus on their refrigerator and called every night for someone to deliver their favorite pot stickers or something. Is that a huge deal in New York still? And when did that develop?
Really early on, because you had people who really didn't have good cooking facilities.
Yeah, you told a story in the first chapter About you could bring your own dish and they'd put stuff.
Yeah, there was takeout in a way. You could go to these places that they'd advertise that we can supply you with hot food. That you send your servant over and we can give, you know, fill a, put in their basket these dishes and they can bring them back home. So you could get that. I guess that sounds like takeout to me.
Mm-hmm.
And I think a lot of the same reasons prevailed, that people were very busy. They had limited facilities for making their own food. And as a convenience, you have all these purveyors who can give them food to take home. And certainly that's – I think, you know, the demographic for this person who lives on takeout is the young, struggling, upwardly mobile New Yorker kind of scratching to make his or her way and just don't have time. Mm-hmm. For food,
and they
so
store
Chinese,
things.
Chinese
in their,
takeout yeah. is the. I mean, I know people who keep books in their ovens.
I was just going to say they store their books and magazines in their ovens because their yeah. apartments are so small.
Yeah, I mean, I'm appalled by that whole idea, but it pushes New Yorkers toward what they've always done, which is it pushes them out to the street and it pushes them toward restaurants and toward. You know, people who make food for a living in a way that you don't find in any other city, I don't think.
Yeah. What do you think right now, if this is even – if it's a fair question, what are the places you like the best in New York right now?
The funny thing is, you know, once you get off the food reviewing beat, it's funny how fast the world turns. If you're not keeping up with it 5 and 6 nights a week, there's a whole new list of restaurants you haven't made it to yet. That everybody,
oh, I know. Yeah,
and everybody's
absolutely.
Going to them, and you feel like you're I feel like I'm on the outside looking in a lot of times mm-hmm. because I tend to haunt the places that I liked in the past.
You get to go back to a place
ones.
A second yeah. or a fourth time when you're not reviewing it anymore.
That's right. You don't have the luxury of going back to the place where you had the great meal. I mean, yeah. Kraft was a good example, of Tom Colicchio's restaurant mm-hmm. before he was the
yes.
world famous Top Chef Tom Colicchio, but he was making. They were just some of the best meals I'd ever had in New York, and I thought, oh, God, I just can't wait till I get back to eat here. And I never – you could never do it yeah. while you're reviewing restaurants.
What do you think of Balthazar?
I like it as – I think it's better than it has a right to be, if I may put it that way. That's
sure.
true a lot of the McNally restaurants, which seem to be totally geared toward fashionistas and the absolute latest in – whoever the great celebrities of the moment are, it seems to be totally tuned for them. And you could get away with serving anything, frankly.
Mm-hmm.
But it's actually pretty good. I find I like less hectic in my dining experience.
Balthazar is hectic. The thing that I love about it is it looks like it's been there for 200 years.
Yes, excellent job.
They did that. Perfectly.
Yeah, they put it over. You know, that's like sleight of hand that's done
yeah,
really well.
That mirror, that huge mirror mm-hmm. and the oyster bar, or the bar, I guess, where they yeah. serve oysters.
And
I just
astounded.
Always
And it's
it
really,
there.
You know, it's retained. Normally, you know, you're on the cutting edge. That's the easiest place to fall off is, mm-hmm. that, is that edge. And,
yeah.
and they've been, you know, they've kept the ball rolling for many years at this point. Yeah. So
I've had many people say to me, oh, Balthazar, that's so last year.
Uh-huh. Well, I don't know. It looks to me like it's
you know, and last
like
decade
popcorn.
And last century, and that's part of. I mean, mm-hmm. the next big thing is fine in certain ways, and it's great for entertainment. And it seems to me that food and cooking and dining has, in many ways, become a very passive form of entertainment. You just want to watch, you know, what the latest rock star is doing. But on the other hand, you feel good in places that have been there for a long time if the food is good.
Yeah, absolutely, and I always like to, you know, do my bit to keep them going. There's a restaurant. It was funny. I had to rewrite the very end of the book because my absolute favorite little secret restaurant, well, not that secret, it was called Fleur de Sel in the Flatiron District, and
uh-huh.
the guy decided he opened. He's from Brittany, and he finally decided to open a little restaurant devoted to the food of Brittany called Bar Breton. And he closed down Fleur de Sel just at the time I was finishing the last chapter there, and I had to do a quick revision there to get in Bar Breton and alert, you know, mention the fact that, alas, Fleur de Sel, the great romantic little French restaurant of my dream, is now gone. But Bar Breton is terrific and terrific value, I think.
It is. Mm-hmm. And one last thing before I let you go, street food.
Street food.
The tradition of street food in New York, I mean anything from a really good hot dog or Polish sausage to Vietnamese sandwiches,
mm-hmm.
that sort of thing. Let's just talk a little bit about street food.
Well, you're wise to bring that up because I think I totally missed the boat when I wrote the book, when I did an early draft of the book. And I had been not aware of this renaissance in street food because I was reviewing all these upscale restaurants.
Yeah.
And we have a sort of divide duties, and there's a 25 and under columnist who covers mm-hmm. the cheap eats. And my memory was totally outdated of what was available in street food. And then when I went back and took a second look, I realized that in the last 15 years or so, there's been this resurgence and a real development in the variety of street foods that you can get. It used to be, when I first moved to New York, it was not so great. I mean, it was just these hot dogs floating in murky water and these knishes that weighed about 3 pounds. And now it's the number of cuisines that are represented in street food is amazing. I mean,
I had the best mm-hmm. lamb shawarma standing in a corner near the Radio and Television Museum. Mm-hmm. I mean, I can just think of so many great things I've had in that context.
Well, there's this famous collection of food stalls out in these ball fields in Red Hook in Brooklyn, where it's a lot of Caribbean and Latin American.
Mm-hmm.
As people go down there, they have a lot of soccer teams, and everybody converges on those ball fields, and then under tents, they can go to this United Nations of Latin and Caribbean food that's just kind of mind-boggling. The streets are in good shape as far as food goes.
One last question. Did you include Shopsins?
I didn't.
It's okay if you didn't. I just thought of Shopsins, even though it's not street food. It's one of the weirdest places. Famous because of Calvin Trillin writing about it.
I didn't know.
Anyway, I went there once, and it's the best part about it is the Calvin Trillin story,
mm-hmm.
I have to say. The guy's a character, but he's sort of a self-created character. Well, Bill, thank you so much. I wish you great luck on your book tour. The book is Appetite City, A Culinary History of New York. Who's the publisher?
North Point Press.
Oh, North Point Press. Oh,
which is part of Firestrauss.
Yeah, mm-hmm. And a hardcover. It's a fabulous holiday gift for yourself or for your favorite food lover. Anyone who loves New York would really love this book. So I really hope it's a great success.
Oh, thank you.
And thanks for stopping by here in Sonoma County. Hope you get a chance to eat something good.
Absolutely, yeah.
And thank you for tuning in. I should say that today marks our official 14th anniversary. Oh my goodness, where has the time gone? 14 years. We will be doing something to commemorate the occasion probably next Sunday. I'm going to pull a few rabbits out of the hat and make it a really memorable show to commemorate 14 years of my life and your ears here on KRCB on Mouthful, the Wine Country's most delicious hour. It's Michelle Anna Jordan. Have a great week.
Mouthful is produced and hosted by Michelle Anna Jordan. Lawrence Alberti is Mouthful's engineer. For more information about Mouthful, send an email to mouthful@michelleannajordan.com. That's Michelle with one L. You can also download Mouthful's free podcast from krcb.org or from iTunes. Good call.